Welcome to the Godspeed Institute, an enlightening and positive forum exploring all the world's religions and spiritual belief systems as an on-air classroom in an effort to help people better understand each other, promote tolerance, and foster peace. I'm your host, Kerr Hallenbeck. Wayne Dossick, Ph.D., is a rabbi, writer, speaker, spiritual guide, and healer who teaches and counsels about faith and spirit, ethical values, life transformations, and evolving human consciousness. He is the founder and spiritual guide of the Elijah Minyan in San Diego, California, a group of Jews seeking to shape and enter Judaism's coming new era through God-centered worship and learning, spiritual renewal, and personal growth. The services Rabbi Dossick conducts and the classes he teaches are highly acclaimed for their deep prayer and meditation, joyous singing and chanting, and warm Haimish atmosphere that encourages deep connection to God and to a community of friends. Rabbi Dossick is the author of Living Judaism, The Complete Guide to Jewish Belief, Tradition, and Practice, The Business Bible, 10 New Commandments for Bringing Spirituality and Ethical Values into the Workplace, When Life Hurts, A Personal Journey from Adversity to Renewal, Soul Judaism, Dancing with God into a New Era, and his latest book is The Real Name of God, Embracing the Full Essence of the Divine. Rabbi, welcome to the program, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you, and it's a pleasure to be with you. And thank you for all the good God work that you are doing.
Oh, thanks so much. Rabbi, you know, in trying to discern a beginning place for our talk, I have to start by saying your books and message and even your photo emanate such joy, so I thought I would start there. Really, what are you so happy about?
Well, I'm alive. It's a beautiful day. There's a Hasidic saying that says, Mitzvah gedola yiyot b'simcha. It's a great injunction to always be in great joy. So I take a look at this world. I'm a child of God. I'm a child of the universe. I have a wonderful wife. I have a great son. I have adorable granddaughters. And I have meaningful work and purpose to life. And what could be bad about those things? You know, it's very interesting. We live in a world where people look and they say, oh, it's such a terrible world. There are hungry people there, where there's warfare, there's tragedy. And that's all true. But it doesn't do any good for us to help make a better world by coming from that same place. If we want to help feed hungry people, it doesn't help if we have empty bellies also. So we come from joy, and we bring that joy to the world. And the interaction of human beings in joy has the possibility of making this world a much better and happier place.
Lately, I've been considering that there's a difference between happiness, which our culture stresses, and joy, and the kind of joy you're talking about makes me want to go die, about life and tradition.
And there, we could get you singing Hasidic melodies already.
I'm there.
That's great.
so let's start there, though. Were you raised in a religious household, and can you tell us about any experiences that inspired or affected you as a young person?
Well, I was raised in a suburban, not quite suburban, more in city, southeast side of Chicago, conservative Jewish household, conservative with a large C, that is the conservative movement in Judaism. My father, of blessed memory, came from an Orthodox background. My mother, of blessed memory, came from a Reform background. They decided they would have an intermarriage, and so they came to what was then the middle ground in Jewish life in America, conservative Judaism, and it meant that we celebrated the Sabbath and the holidays, but we were not Orthodox in all observances and practices. An experience that, well, actually it's a whole lifestyle experience, because probably the most important experiences of my teenage life, my high school years, came as a member of the synagogue youth group. It was called USY, United Synagogue Youth. The United Synagogue was the name of the conservative movement. And we had local events, regional events, national events, and that shaped my religious practices, my religious thinking, the beginning of my spirituality, also leadership skills and social justice activities. And some of the friends that I made there well more than 50 years ago are still friends, and many who went into Jewish professional life as well, colleagues today. Just the other day on Facebook, I saw the name of somebody that I thought I knew. I was in Chicago, she was in Pennsylvania, and she now lives in Tel Aviv, and I friended her on Facebook, and within 2 minutes, she had friended me back, reminding us of our shared experiences in that youth group all those years ago. So that was the entree into deeply committed Jewish life.
Thank you so much for sharing that. It's a powerful thing to make that kind of connection as a young person. It helps to really give you direction and form your life as you go forward. Now, you said Southeast Chicago. What's the neighborhood? Just out of curiosity.
It was called South Shore. It was close to the lake. Hyde Park was the University of Chicago, and this is further south. So if you're familiar with Chicago, Hyde Park is in the 50s, and this is in the 80s, 70s, 80s, and 90s on the south side.
Oh, gosh, yes.
Near the lake as opposed to the west side.
I went to high school for some time at Highland High School in Indiana, which is not far from there.
Well, we came across to go to Phil Schmidt's for perch.
Oh, gosh.
Remember that great restaurant,
yes,
Phil Schmidt's?
And we used to ditch sometimes to have a special day in Chicago. let's go to Water Tower Place today. But anyway, now you are the longest serving rabbi in San Diego County. How long is that?
In June, I will celebrate the 40th anniversary of my ordination, and I have been in San Diego for the last 37 of those 40 years.
Mm, congratulations.
Thank you.
You must have seen a whole lot in the past four decades of service. Now, when did you know that you wanted to become a rabbi?
Well, my career goal when I was in high school was to be governor of Illinois, senator from Illinois, and president of the United States. And we were the children of, literally the children of the 60s. So I spent a good deal of my life on anti-war picket lines and a good deal of my life on pro-civil rights picket lines. And we helped foster the feminist revolution. And so we were social justice kids. And I thought that that's the way I would do it, through the establishment and to bring some street wisdom into the establishment. I toyed with the idea of being a rabbi, but I wasn't quite serious about it. I went to the last 2 years of undergraduate school at the University of Cincinnati, which is right down the street from the Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati, which is my seminary, and I lived in the dorms there, and I was part of the seminary community, but I was reluctant to activate my formal application to rabbinical school. And the day Bobby Kennedy was killed, I went to the dean and I said, activate my application. I now know I can no longer do it through the streets, and the establishment, the political establishment, is certainly not listening to us and not responding to us. And for sure, later in 68, when we got beaten up in Grant Park at the Democratic Convention, I was utterly certain of that. And so I thought that I could do the things that we wanted to do in terms of God and social justice through the what's still called the bully pulpit of the synagogue.
So transforming from within the structure was something that you abandoned then?
Within the political structure, yes.
Yes, and so.
And
then,
sadly, I've been proven right over these last 45 years.
Right. I've also wondered if transformation really happens one heart at a time, so that we can't necessarily approach it systematically. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that's a good deal of what this new book, The Real Name of God, is about, and that is oneness consciousness. part of the lesson of that of this book is that seemingly the theme song of the world today for so many is, my God's better than your God, and if you don't believe me, I will become an extremist, I'll become a fundamentalist, and then I'll become a terrorist, and you will either come along willingly or I will impose my beliefs upon you. That's what's going on in the world today. You know, I, as I said, I was born on the southeast side of Chicago, and when we were young, that is in the late 40s and the early 50s, we all played together on the playground. And then we went to public school, and some of the kids went to the local parochial school, the Catholic school. I remember its name to this day, St. Mary Magdalene. By the time I was 7 or 8, 9 years old, I was being beaten up on a regular basis by my former friends who had learned from their priests and nuns that I, Wayne Dossick, had personally killed their Lord. Now, fast forward 40, 50 years or so, I'm not exactly sure of the time, I'm a rabbi on the faculty of a Catholic university teaching the only courses in Jewish studies in the Department of Theology and working with the Monsignor for Mission and Ministry to create an all-faith service for the first Friday of the second semester of the school where people of all faiths come and lead prayers in their own traditions in the Immaculata. I preached from the pulpit of the Immaculata standing next to a statue of Jesus. And one of my closest and dearest friends in the entire world is a Jesuit priest. Now, for all these centuries, we had the Crusades and the Inquisition and the pogroms, and it was Christian against Jew. And here we are now, in a period of only 50 years, and we give great credit to that twinkle-eyed Pope, Pope John the 23rd, that here we are living together, loving together. Well, it's possible with the entire world if we are aware of the oneness of the world. In other words, God says, it's not one religion that's better than the other. I don't care what language I'm prayed to in. I don't care what you call yourself. I don't even care what you call me. But there is one God who is the parent of us all, who says to us, I love you all. You are all my children. And I love all my children equally. I don't play any favorites. And now is the time, this moment in time, is the time to understand that, because with the technology and the science that we have created, we are at that moment in time where we can either learn to live together in unity and harmony, or we will destroy each other and perish. We look at each other as human beings, as children of God. And there are many ways to do that. We can talk about some of those ways later if you want.
Right, right.
But there are many ways to do that, and that's what's at stake at this moment.
Yes, no, I appreciate that. That's our whole raison d'etre here at the Godspeed Institute. And it's wonderful to hear you speak so plainly and candidly about that. Now, I just want to raise the question, since God loves all his children equally, does that make the idea of a chosen people somewhat passé?
Well, the chosenness was not for special privilege, it was for responsibility. And don't forget, it was chosen not against the Christians, but in response to the pagan world. And basically, the Jews were chosen for the responsibility of receiving and living and learning and then teaching God's word and will to the world. So the monotheistic God in a pagan world where it was there were many, many, many gods extant and recognized, the Jewish mission was to say the one God who is the one God who loves us all is an ethical monotheist. This one God has given us a series of sublime rules by which to live and interact as human beings. And that was the reason for the chosenness.
In my family, my father was Jewish and my mother Catholic. So this works very well together for me, especially in that Jesus was Jewish. The experience of communion resonates, of course, with Passover and the Sabbath. Now, you've been described as a, quote, rational intellect with the soul of a mystic. Can we talk about that balance and the nature of the mystic perspective and what it adds to this picture?
If I'm a rational intellect, it's very sweet of people to say so. But it means that, in many, many ways, I do what a whole lot of other people do, is I learn, I revere learning, I revere books, I revere the messages that people give. I have a whole slew of degrees of academic achievement. I have honorary degrees. That makes me a rational intellect. I think clearly, and I think rationally. But at the same time, I know that that's not where life really leads us. Rational learning is important, but it is not the reason for being. People ask, what's the purpose of life? Well, the purpose, and then you go to the high mountaintop and ask the guru, what's the purpose of life? The purpose of life is really very, very simple, as it is profound. The purpose of life is to know God. And to know God is to know love, because God is love. And so, if I'm described as having the soul of a mystic, it is because I strive every single day, every single moment, to be in deep, personal, intimate, loving relationship with God. And I've dedicated a great deal of my life, certainly the second half of my rabbinate, when I moved, let us say, beyond the message of only social justice. The second half of my life has been dedicated to helping people create that safe and sacred connection to develop that deep and intimate and personal and loving relationship with God. And if that's what being a mystic is, then indeed I'm a mystic. The second half is equally important, and that is, in prayer or meditation, we always say, we come to talk to God. It's only half the equation. The other half of the equation is to listen, when God talks to us, when God talks to you personally. And so there are all kinds of ways to be in touch with God. Prayer and meditation and chant and exercise and study and yoga and dance and movement. There are all kinds of ways. My the biggest way is through chant. And so I help people learn chants and also prayers and poems and meditations that will help them on the journey, the spiritual pathway to be in that intimate relationship with God and to listen when God talks to you.
What chants are you referring to? Is this from the Jewish tradition?
There are many, many chants that are from the Jewish tradition. We have a number of Hasidic chants. I have put together a number of chants. There's a previous book that my wife and I wrote together called 20 Minute Kabbalah, a daily personal spiritual practice, which is 20 minutes of chanting, and that book is available, and it has a CD in the back. With this new book, The Real Name of God, so the whole first half of the book is sort of like a mystery novel. It's to find out what is the real name, the one name of the one God. And then the second half is how do you get in touch, how do you connect with that God? And so there are more than 30 chants in the book. We put them all on the website. The website is www.godisanochi.com. And there you can go and listen, as we used to say on the South Side of Chicago, free for nothing. You can listen to all 30 chants. So that's each of these chants is for a particular reason, with particular words, with a particular melody. In chanting, we come closer and closer to God, and in the silence that follows the chant, we integrate that closeness, and also you chant enough that sometime during the day, one or more of those chants will bubble up, and you will say, wow, why am I singing this particular chant at this moment? And you will see that the words or the melody are vital and crucial to what's going on in your life at that very second.
That's fascinating. Now, Rabbi, what led you to form the Elijah Minyan?
The Elijah Minyan is a group of people who came together about close to 22 years ago now, for whom the large suburban synagogues were no longer working. And truth be told, they were no longer working for me either. I had a big congregation with a big salary and a big staff and all kinds of programming. But I stood on the pulpit and I saw that which is most important, that is helping people create that deep personal intimate relationship with God, just wasn't working for people. And so I took a gigantic leap and I said, with a group of people who were like-minded, we'll put together this little group called the Elijah Minyan. It will be a laboratory for exploring reemerging Jewish spirituality and how we come to God. And it will meet in people's living rooms. I had already built two large synagogues in San Diego. I didn't want to do a third. So over these years, while it could have grown and grown and grown, we've kept it small enough to stay in people's living rooms. And we come together for God-centered worship, and some learning, and some social activities, and some social justice activities, all those other things. But we don't have a Hebrew school, and we don't have a men's club, we don't have a sisterhood, we don't have a large salary for a rabbi, and we don't have a building fund, which, of course, is the greatest thing in Jewish life, not to have a building fund. That was a joke.
I know.
And it's worked all these years. People really find this a great place to be safe and sacred in connecting to God.
Well, you know, that's wonderful what you just shared. It's like you used to have power churches, or what we call those today. But it is true that, you know, once church becomes about a building, then everything becomes about paying for the roof.
Right.
In any tradition, I think. And it's interesting because at the very beginnings, for example, in the Christian church, that's exactly where, you know, folks met, were in each other's houses. And I think the Amish carry that on today, where the service rotates you know, weekly to someone else's house, and it keeps things very real and
I would tell you
close.
That people stand in line waiting to be the host family because they think it brings, and they know it brings, such holiness to their own home.
Mm. You mentioned there's no Hebrew school. Are you approaching this entirely as like the whole family gathers, including the kids?
Well, really, this is an adult group, and sadly, it's the one thing that is the saddest thing for me about this group, is that we don't have many young families. We have a few, but we don't have many young families. It is mostly an adult group.
In the introduction, I mentioned this phrase, and I want to come back to you with that, in which you referred to Judaism's coming new era. And I think this is important. And I'd like to ask you about that from your point of view. What is the new era? What is emerging?
If you don't mind, it's going to be a little bit of a history lesson in order
that's,
to tell
that's
that.
Great.
That
Go
right?
ahead. Sure.
All right. So Judaism has had two eras, two periods. The first was the biblical period, and it was characterized in many, many ways by the possibility of individual prophecy, that at any given moment God could and would talk to any individual and say, talk or envision to or dream into by day or by night. In other words, there would be direct divine communication, direct experience, being in the Holy Presence, and then sometimes the message was to the individual by him or herself, and sometimes God said, go out and tell this to the rest of the people. And so that's how we get Isaiah and Ezekiel and Jeremiah and all the other boys and girls. At a certain point, and this is the period between 200 before the Common Era and 200 of the Common Era, and a very, very important place, a very vital place in Jewish life. It's the Maccabean Revolution and the birth and death of Jesus and the beginnings of the development of Christianity, the destruction of the Holy Temple and the exile, destruction by the Romans, and this is the place where the synagogue replaces the Holy Temple, prayer replaces sacrifice, and the scholar-rabbi replaces the priests. It's a tremendous fermenting period. So at that point, the sages and the rabbis came along and they said, of course, but we're creating a new era, the second era of Judaism. With all these changes, we are going to call this the rabbinic period, and it will be most characterized by the end of biblical prophecy. God will not talk to individuals anymore. God will just come to us, the scholars and the sages. And that's the way continuing revelation will come. and we will hear God's word and give it out to you. We will call this Jewish law, and you follow it. So the biblical period was about 2,000 years. The rabbinic period has been going on for these 2,000 years. But to me, it seems as if the rabbinic period is giving way to Judaism's third era. Now, this will take hundreds of years, just like it took 400 years or more last time. This will take hundreds of years as well, because most Jews, except for the very Orthodox, are not following the law that the sages give out, or gave out. And so we're coming into Judaism's third era, which nobody named yet, so I got to name it. I call it Neshama Judaism, or Soul Judaism, which will be most characterized by the return to the deep, personal, intimate, loving relationship between God and each individual, and therefore prophecy, that is, that God will talk to you, and you will hear God's word as equally as anyone else. It will be totally egalitarian Judaism. And so that's the new era that's coming, and whether I'm right or wrong, come back in 500 years, we'll know.
Thank you so much. That's fascinating. I want to return to that again in the second part of the show. We're about halfway through, Rabbi, and I'm just going to take a short break for a little station ID, so please just stay on the line. This is Care Hallenbeck, and you're listening to the Godspeed Institute, a program dedicated to spiritually based living and religious tolerance. When we return from the break, we'll continue our conversation with author and Rabbi Wayne Dossick, Ph.D. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Godspeed Institute. You're live with Care, and we're speaking with author and teacher Rabbi Wayne Dossick about the new era of Judaism. Now, Rabbi, I'd like to touch base on what we were just discussing in the first part of the show when we're talking about the new era, the third age of Judaism, as you described, emerging now and being a much more direct communication between God and the people. Can you share a little more about what that might look like and how it might be lived out?
Well, in many, many ways, this is what led to me to start exploring and then eventually write the new book, The Real Name of God, Embracing the Full Essence of the Divine. Because my question to myself was, if this is so, if I'm going to have this deep, personal, intimate relationship with God, to whom am I speaking? To whom am I speaking? It means that Judaism has at least 20, 30, 40 different names for God. Christianity has, at the very least, the Trinity with three faces of God. Islam has a name for God. Hinduism has 99 names, and some say 999 names. So my question was, how does this one perfect God have all these different names? And to which name should I be addressing my conversations? And second, I wondered, why is it that the one perfect God, who is the God of love, the God of compassion and tenderness, the God who gives us this sterling ethical code by which to live, why is it that in the Bible, this God is also male and hierarchical and domineering and authoritarian and harsh and angry and opens up the earth to swallow the unfaithful and decimates enemies? How could the one perfect God do that and be such a contradiction and a paradox and a mystery? And so my question became, who is God? And what is the name of the real name of God? Is there the one name of the one God? And so it occurred to me that each and every one of the names we have for God, all of the names we have for God, none of them is the name of the whole, complete, total God. So if you picture a beach ball, for example, the beach ball has many, many colored panels. The divine beach ball has those many, many colored panels, and each one is an aspect or an attribute or a behavior or a manifestation of God to which we've given a name, but none is the name of the whole beach ball. And so my question was, what is the name of the whole beach ball, the divine beach ball? And could I go back into the Bible itself and by reimagining and retranslating and challenging long-held comfortable beliefs, could I find the name of the real God hiding in plain sight for all these years, just waiting for the right energetic moment in time to be revealed? And I found it. So I found the real name of God, and not only did I find it, I found that the sages throughout history, various sages, knew it and left us hints in their writings, in the Jewish sacred books, the Midrash and the Talmud and the Zohar, and one of the Hasidic Rebbe's, the Ishpitzer Rebbe knew, and they left us all the hints in their writings, which I put all into the footnotes of the book. But it just wasn't the right energetic moment in time for them to reveal the name, but this is the right energetic moment in time. So God gave me this discovery and gave out this revolutionary revelation of the real name of God.
And is this a name of God that can actually be spoken?
Yes. Actually, it can absolutely be spoken. It's like, you see, one of the issues that has been ours all this time is we think God is so far away and so sacred and so holy that we can hardly speak the name of God. But you could say that about your lovely husband, too, right? But wouldn't you like to say that I can talk to this God, I can be with this God in pillow talk? I want to.
Wow.
I want to know God that intimately.
Yes.
And so, yes. So you ask, what is the real name of God? The real name of God is Anochi. Anochi. It's one of those words, like Hanukkah and Challah.
Yes.
But it's best understood as in Johann Sebastian Bach.
Got it.
Bach, like Anochi.
Mm-hmm.
So Anochi is usually translated as I, like me, I. But Hebrew has another word for I, which is the small self, the personal ego. This I is the fullness, the completeness, the totality of God. So it's used in the Bible 359 times. Every time it is in the voice of God, it is used when no aspect or attribute of God is enough for the event or the teaching, but the whole God, the complete God, has to be there for the event or the teaching. It is also used in the voice of human beings when a human being asks, how do I touch God within? How do I come into the fullness of my God self? How do I be most godlike in my human behavior? And so the name of the one God gives us the fullness, the totality of both the transcendent God, that is the God of creation and history, and the God, the immanent God, the God within, the God self within each human being.
Hmm. You know, that phrase, that pillow talk with God, that was great. thank you for that. As an author on the saints, it brings to mind the poetry, like the love poetry of St. John of the Cross, and, you know, resting with the beloved like that. And, you know, another thing about...
Well, I'll tell you, this is very interesting. I had an email from a pastor in upstate New York, whom, of course, I'd never met, and he said to me, I think that the word Anochi is not only in the Hebrew Bible, Genesis through the end, but it's also in the Gospel of John. Can you help me? And unfortunately, I couldn't because I don't know either Greek or Latin, but he spent the next 3 or 4 weeks exploring it, and he wrote back to me and said, I'm absolutely convinced that Anochi is in the Gospel of John also.
Well, we'll have to find some earlier texts of that, go back further, before it got translated into Greek. And a lot of words changed by then, by the way, as you know. Now, how does this help, now, to know the actual full, the name of the complete God? How does this help you, then, in prayer, in your depth of understanding, in your compassion? Can you share that?
Well, it helps in 4 major ways. Which I call the 4 reformations, world-changing reformations. Number 1, Anochi is a genderless word, or better, genderful. So it takes away our issues of he, she, or it about God. Now, we can't do much about the Hebrew language or English language, which has gender words, so it's still very difficult. But Anochi is a genderless word, which means that it is both genders. It is male and female. And that means that the beach ball is the everything of the everything, which includes all the seeming contradictions or paradoxes of the mysteries of the universe. So the divine beach ball that is God in God's fullness is male and female, right and wrong, good and evil, light and dark, justice and mercy, all the seeming opposites are really all in God. Jung understood this half a century ago or more when he talked about the archetypes within.
Rabbi, may I add? You just explained the phrase in Genesis when humans are created in our image, male and female.
Well, in the reflection, I like the word reflection better, in the reflection of God, because that takes us away from this whole business about, well, what does God look like? Does God have physical qualities? I like the word, in modern Hebrew, the word that's used for image is also used for photography. So you create an image, but you create a reflection of what you're seeing for a photograph.
But your lesson addresses the wholeness, yes.
The everything of the everything. Right.
Yes.
Number 2, it takes away this notion of the harsh, angry, militant, male, hierarchical, domineering God. We learn that that is only one aspect of God, one panel of God. But since we think that that is the wholeness of God, mistakenly, that so many kids and thinking people get stuck there and can't move on. We have kids who go off and get PhDs in French literature and microbiology, and they still have 12-year-old formulations and images of God, theologies of God, because they got stuck there in this harsh male hierarchical God. So what we can say is that that is one panel of the God, but it is not the whole God. The third thing is, and we've discussed this already, and that is that it is, that we learned that this is both the transcendent God of creation and history and the immanent God, the God within, the God of breath and soul. And the fourth thing, and we discussed this at the beginning, is that this is a God of oneness. Oneness for all peoples, all religions, no religion, people of all faiths, of no faith. This is the one God of the universe. And at this moment in time, that's probably the most exciting and the most important and the most hopeful revelation. And that is, now's the time, folks. Now's the time for serious oneness consciousness. what happened with the Jews and Christians can now happen with Jews, Christians, and Muslims, with people of Eastern religions, with people of no religion. Now is the time for the world to come into oneness. Now, you may laugh, and you would say, oh, the world's such a mess right now, and how can you even be talking about such things?
I'm not laughing.
I would tell you this. Remember back to 1987, a whole bunch of us stood around the whole world, held hands, and sang songs. We called it the harmonic convergence. You remember that? And we thought we were going to bring peace to the world. And then the mainstream said to us, oh, you guys are crazy. You're old aging hippies. What's wrong with you? And so I would just ask, if in 1986, a year before the harmonic convergence, I had said to you, I predict that in the next 20 years, the Berlin Wall will fall, communism will fall in the Soviet Union, all the Soviet satellite countries will become democratic, the blacks and whites will be riding the bus together in South Africa, Protestants and Catholics will stop shooting each other in Northern Ireland, and now and then Israelis and Palestinians will sit down at the peace table. You would have called the guys in the white coats to cart me away. You would have said, you're crazy. But it all happened. Did it all happen because we all stood around, held hands, and sung together? No. Well, maybe yes. Maybe that was a move toward oneness consciousness. Maybe that was a move toward bringing more light into the world. Maybe that was a move toward enlightenment for all beings. Because if people around the world, your so-called friends and your so-called enemies, are standing around doing the exact same thing for the exact same purpose. You know, back in the 60s, we said, what if they called a war and nobody came?
Right.
Or somebody came to me once and said, you know, you have this prayer for peace in your service, in your worship service, and Jews pray three times a day. And you've been praying for peace three times a day, every day, and there is no peace. So I said, you know, if everybody in the universe prayed for peace at exactly the same moment, for at least that moment, we'd have peace.
That's right. It is possible.
That's the same thing here. If we understand what's at stake in oneness consciousness, if we understand not only the God of a communal covenant, but the God of a deep personal covenant, and how we can act with this, that God, how we can be with that God, then we can begin to see each other as really as children of God. Mm-hmm. There's a verse in the Psalms that says, I place God before me always. What does it mean? Well, the kids on the street would say, I put God in my face. What does it mean to put God in your face? It means to remember, to be conscious that God is everywhere, because God is everywhere, in your face and behind you and on your right side and your left side and above and below. All you have to do is be ever consciously aware of that. And so therefore, that makes you a total child of God because you're in that relationship with God. And when you go into the bank and have to stand in line because the teller is so slow, or when you go into the convenience store and the teenage clerk can't make change for a dollar bill without using the computer, or when some guy cuts you off in traffic, instead of cursing and getting frustrated, you can say, that's a child of God just like I'm a child of God, and we understand that God is within both of us. It's almost the way the Hindus say, namaste.
Right.
The God within me acknowledges the God within you. And if I know that that's a child of God, I can't treat that child of God any worse than I want to be treated. If I know that you are a child of God, I can't cheat you in business because I'd be cheating myself and my God. And so there are ways.
Right.
So, for example, the chant that goes like that goes, Shiviti Ahanochi Lehenegdi Tamin, Shiviti Ahanochi Lehenegdi Tamin. Or you can just sing Anochi's name over and over again. Anochi, 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 Anochi. If you sing that in traffic, then the guy who cuts you off is not so terrible because it's a God moment.
Mm.
And that's what we can do to bring God into our lives.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much for that, Rabbi, and for singing the chant as well. Now, you raised something before, you know, how did this God become such a hierarchical, static image in religion? I just wanted to come back to that for a moment, because it does happen that for different reasons and throughout all faiths around the world, that when we organize and become hierarchical, we wind up doing the same thing to God, and God has a static image. And that's a change. For example, in Scripture, let's say in the New Testament, Jesus refers to himself in so many thought-provoking ways and symbols, like that really involve imagination, like the bread of life, the gate, the door, the vine, the way, the shepherd. There are all kinds of images, to name but a few. But we do become more rigid sometimes as we organize in certain ways. And I wanted to ask you then, does the mystical side help to address this in terms of imagination?
No institution can hold the light for very long. And what we are seeing right now is a breakdown of all the institutions in the world: the economy, education, healthcare, governments, religions. There's a breakdown. And why is that? Because people are coming to realize that the institution can't hold the light, and it has to be a personal relationship between people and people, not so much through religions. Jesus calling himself all of those things were attributic, the vine and the shepherd, all of those are attributes of a Godhead. Or, and see, by the way, my priest friend says that this discovery of Anochi solves for him the mystery of the Trinity, because it's no longer one God in three parts, it's three faces of the one God. Very different and subtle, but very important. Not three gods in one, but three faces of the one God.
Yes.
So yes, we have all kinds of ways to bring light to our world.
Now, I believe as we get older and our relationship with God deepens, I think our image of God also needs to evolve, you know, from what it was in childhood to this more adult, you know, mature version of God, beyond boundaries and beyond boxes and such. But how, and here's a question now, because humans are humans, how do we get folks not to get into the "my Anochi is better than your Anochi"?
You know, my wife's better than your wife, my husband's better than your husband, my kid's better than your kid, my kid's an honor student and your kid isn't. Look what that does. Mm. Competition, competition, competition.
That's right.
And it does us no good. We have to move beyond it. We do it in many, many different ways. I said as silly as it is, from the pulpit on Yom Kippur, I said, take a Muslim to lunch. Take a Muslim to lunch? What does that mean?
Why is that silly?
It sounds silly, doesn't it?
No, it sounds nice.
Right, well, so that's it. Take a Muslim to lunch. We don't understand Muslim. And pray for this new pope. He's got it, I think.
He's what?
He's got it. He understands. He understands that that the relationship with God is a personal, intimate one, and he's going to really, really shake up the church.
I hope so. He's got a heck of a namesake to live up to.
Right, and he should only live and be well.
Your vision and spirituality clearly relate to other traditions and can help to bring people together, which is wonderful, mm-hmm. because that is, you know, the way it's going. I would call it sort of the death and resurrection of all things is what we're looking at. And what comes out of it is going to be, you know, a very interesting development, as you were talking about earlier. As we come to the end of this interview, though, do you have any final thoughts or hopes you'd like to share with our listeners, and even perhaps a blessing?
Well, thank you. That's very sweet of you to ask. When this program is being recorded, and I know it will be played many times over many, many months, I hope many people listen to it. But as this is being recorded, we are on the very close to the eve of Passover and a week away from Easter. And the themes of both Passover and Easter are the themes of rebirth and redemption. And we invite Elijah the prophet to our Passover Seder, because at that moment in the Seder, the theme changes from the telling of historical redemption to the hope and the promise of ultimate redemption. And we are coming, I believe, closer and closer to that era. The more we touch hands, the more we respect and honor each other, the more we relate to each other, the more intimate relationships we have with each other, and therefore, and the more we understand what God wants from us as children of God and as children of the universe, we come closer and closer to ultimate redemption. And so that is my prayer and my blessing, that we move toward a real understanding of one God, one world, one people, Eden on earth once again. And that is one of the last chants in the book. It goes like this: one God, one world, one people. One God, one world, one people. One God, one world, one people. Eden on earth. One God, one world, one people. One God, one world, one people. One God, one world, one people. Eden on earth. That should come speedily and in our day. That is our prayer. May it be your will, God.
Amen, Rabbi. Thank you so much.
Amen.
That was just lovely and a very blessed moment on the Godspeed Institute. Listeners, I also want to let you know that all of Rabbi Dasik's contact information and all of his books will be posted online shortly at GodspeedInstitute.com. And just once again, Rabbi, I want to thank you so much for being our guest today. It's been a wonderful hour speaking.
Well, thank you for caring.
And as my father would have said, Aziz in Pesach.
All right? That a girl. Good
there
you for
go.
You.
Okay.
Aziz in Pesach. That's great.
Take care.
You're the
now.
Best.
Okay.
As Rabbi Shlomo Karlbach would say, one of my rabbis, you're the sweetest and the holiest.
All right. Now, before we close today's program, Rabbi Dasik talked a lot about the holidays today. He mentioned Passover coming and Easter next week, and the celebration in general for all faiths. I just wanted to share with you a reflection about the holidays from my first book, Dear Little One, which is coming up on an anniversary. There'll be a new edition of it out shortly. Here's an example of something you can do while you're traveling. This book, Dear Little One, began as a journal that I kept while commuting to work in New York, on the Metro North Line, in fact, and when I was expecting my first child and still going to the office. I wrote this on the train back and forth. It was a great way of remaining connected to what was happening to me as an expectant mom in the world, and it was also a great way to prepare for my day as well as debrief from the day. I shared my thoughts with my upcoming child, and this was one of them. Remember to enjoy the holidays, however you choose to spend them. Whether at home or abroad, resting with family, or traveling among strangers, keep the holidays full of meaning. Keep love in your heart and joy for those around you. Rejoice in their humanity, remembering the precious gift we all are to each other. Rejoice in the Spirit, as we are all children born from love. See the glow of the candles, the starshine, and the light that illumines every heart, and you will perceive how the experience of holidays is actually much larger than the day, the gifts, or the feast. Remember, too, that you are a child of your parents only in part. The larger part of you is a child of God, to whom you truly belong. You are a child of the universe. Nurture the joy and the magic that you are. Delve into the mystery, into the shining glow of the holidays, and into you. Thank you for joining us for the Godspeed Institute today. The Godspeed Institute is an independent educational organization dedicated to the necessity of spiritually based living and to promoting religious tolerance. If you would like to hear this or any of our previous programs again or send it to someone, simply go to GodspeedInstitute.com. Please send your comments to office@godspeedinstitute.com. We always enjoy hearing from you. And join us again as we continue to explore all the world's religions and spiritual belief systems right here. Until then, we wish you Godspeed on your journey.